Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, and we are here on episode 151 on April 4th, 2024. I hope you had a wonderful elongated Easter weekend. My guest this week is Donald Kimball. He's the communications manager at the Washington Policy Center and a contributor at Young Voices. We talked about social media content moderation, showing the stark differences between the European approach and what some lawmakers are pushing for in the United States. You'll hear the entire exchange at the end of this episode. Also in this episode, Dutch airline KLM has misled consumers on claims that their green credentials are better than they actually are, say judges in Amsterdam, and soaring chocolate prices hit consumers as Ivory Coast and others fail to deliver enough cocoa. So let's get started with this story from Dutch News. KLM misled consumers with green claims, says the courts. Airline KLM has misled consumers by making vague green claims in advertisements, judges in Amsterdam said on Wednesday, in a court case brought by environmental campaign group Fossielvrij NL. Yeah, sorry to all the Dutch listeners. In some adverts, the airline made vague and general, quote, claims about environmental advantages, while in others, the airline exaggerated the impact of using sustainable fuels and planting trees, the court said in its ruling. These sort of measures have a minimal effect on the impact of flying and give rise to the impression that using KLM services is a sustainable activity, the court said. In addition, slogans such as Step Towards a Sustainable Future do not make it clear what measures the company is taking and how they benefit the environment. Well, I think overall, the fact that airlines make these claims is because they're under a significant amount of pressure. We've covered extensively to what extent KLM is coming under pressure to reduce their flights out of Schiphol Airport, which is their hub. And Air France, KLM, of course, the group being in trouble following the COVID pandemic and trying to get passengers back on their flights. Of course, passengers are back up in numbers to travel. And some are concerned about the environmental impact. Of course, new aircraft have better performance, sustainable aviation fuels on the rise, all things we've discussed. But of course, it is really difficult for airlines to make good claims and reliable claims on some of these issues. But I think just as vague as airlines will be, just the same level of vagueness can be prescribed to the policies that governments prescribe when they want things to become more sustainable, when they declare a year of sustainability. All of these terms are very ill-defined, and slapping fines on companies because they make sort of green claims or that they care about sustainability, I think that's just very performative, and it doesn't really advance the issue that we're trying to face here. What we're trying to look at is how to make aviation more sustainable by having eventually electric or hydrogen or whatever the alternative fuel is going to be. But also allowing people continuously to be able to travel. And that is just something that, often is missing. So I think the courts here are, trying to impose themselves, say, hey, don't make any green claims. But of course, in one way, airlines need to be incentivized also to make that. And of course, the biggest incentive for airlines is kerosene prices, and as those go up or are volatile, airlines are naturally incentivized to try and switch to something else, or at least to use less. Ultimately, the big changes are made by airlines and actually not by consumers. I know very few people that go on intercontinental flights, but then also try to make it as sustainable as possible. I mean, there's some search options with Google Flights that tells you that, your carbon footprint will be lower if you fly this airline. Maybe some people do care about that. But I think ultimately the effect of these ad campaigns are sort of overblown. Another story that will hit your pocketbooks if you like chocolate. With cocoa prices at an all-time high, $9,500 in the commodity markets for cocoa, per metric ton. These are some of the highest prices, which does affect the price of chocolate. If for the Easter holidays you were buying chocolate eggs, you probably have noticed, or you maybe downgraded on the quality of the product in order to offset the price increase. And of course, chocolate makers are not happy. Now, the reason for that is a diminished supply, especially out of Ivory Coast, which is one of the biggest suppliers. Or even, I think, the biggest supplier of cocoa in the world. And some of these producing countries in Africa and West Africa specifically have seen diminishing crops for 3 years on end because of changing climate, increased temperatures, and also sometimes lack, sometimes too high rainfall, which has affected their harvest. And of course, one of the problems for a lot of these countries is that they haven't really opened themselves up to new crop varieties through gene editing, which would be more resistant to a lot of these climate events. And as a result of that, they don't really stand a chance when it comes to the changing weather events. And I think that is something, you know, I'll want to discuss. I have an interview lined up where I talk on a network that covers commodity prices specifically. I will talk about that if that interview comes through. But it's something that definitely affects consumers and just adds to sort of the cost of living crisis. Politico ran an interesting email newsletter where they talked about this. And what was interesting at the end is that they had a quote from somebody who was in a chocolate shop in Brussels, and this person says, quote, "I don't think I'll ever stop eating chocolate, no matter what the price." This person is inside a Lindt shop on Rue du Luxembourg at the heart of the capital's European quarter, and he also continues saying, quote, "It's not like cigarettes or alcohol or drugs or sex, it's something else," end of quote. And I think maybe some of you can agree with that. Chocolate is just something else, and of course for those countries like Switzerland and Belgium that are have sort of a national brand attached to chocolate, these price hikes are definitely a factor. Now let's move to the interview of the week. My guest this week is Donald Kimball. He's the communications manager at the Washington Policy Center and a contributor at Young Voices. We talk about content moderation and the differences between Europe and the United States, because some Republican lawmakers actually want you to be able to say anything you like on social media. So take it away. So the listeners will know that we've had a lot of conversations on this podcast before about content moderation. What should the rules be? Recently, an interview with Karen Melko from the Renew Group in the European Parliament about what the Digital Services Act is all about, and how do we try to fit a what's the expression? I think it's square peg in a round hole, or the other way around. But in any case, I'm back here joined by Donald Kimball, who you've heard on the podcast before, and when we talked about fair share taxes, and I wanted to have him back to discuss sort of what the news is here in content moderation, and we have some news that could be relevant for the listeners. So, Donald, what's going on?
Thanks so much for having me back. I appreciate it. And this is an issue in the United States. We have a couple of online social media free speech cases that are going on. There's two that I want to talk about today, and they're both from the same. Well, there are two laws, one from Texas and one from Florida, and then NetChoice is the group that is challenging both of those. So they're kind of collectively referred to as the NetChoice's cases. They were both heard on the same day, and they're very similar in stature there. And this is a complicated issue to start out with. It's one of those areas where I don't think it's an obvious thing. Like, you know, if you support the side I disagree with, clearly you want to censor everything, or you don't want to censor everything. And it's a very complicated thing. People within my own organization at Washington Policy Center, we have good disagreements on this because we like free speech. And so, you know, we like debating on the best ways to get there. But the gist of these laws, essentially, they, in the wake of a lot of interference with elections and social media companies going in and censoring content, shutting down stories that had seemed to have been a conservative bias, that, in the sense that all the stories they were shutting down were conservative. Texas and Florida each passed laws that there's different nuances to each of them, but the general gist is that they would require these social media companies to allow viewpoints regardless of the viewpoints on these particular issues. So they don't have the ability to moderate based on viewpoints. And if they do ban content, they have to justify this content through written explanation and transparency. And this would include deleting content. It would include restricting the visibility of the content or otherwise editing. And it's tricky because on the outset, I sympathize with the conservatives who had their content censored. We saw things like the government, the United States federal government, directly contacting groups like Twitter and saying, hey, these are posts we want you to take down, which under the United States First Amendment would not be allowed. So they're telling the Twitter, hey, do our dirty work for us, basically. And there was even a little bit of pushback. This was before Elon Musk purchased Twitter, notably. And they would say, hey, this doesn't actually fall within our content guidelines. And then the government came in and said, well, you should modify your guidelines then. And so it was a little bit tricky here. So I sympathize, but I think that the problem is these laws actually will create less free speech because by allowing all viewpoints without any kind of discrimination, you put these companies in a tricky spot where they now have to risk allowing very heinous kinds of viewpoints on their platform that will chase away advertisers, that could potentially bring up lawsuits if they do moderate that content. And even if they're going to win, that's expensive and costly. And so these platforms are much more likely to have a broad policy of, guess what? No one gets to talk about this particular issue now because we don't want to have to go through the hassle of moderating really, really heinous things, explaining every single one, as well as having to deal with people who are expressing really, really detestable viewpoints and then saying, nope, that's actually allowed, and advertisers running away from that. Because part of the laws would also say you can't restrict the ability of a post to get proper monetization. So ads can't be, an advertiser couldn't say, hey, I don't want my content associated with that. That wouldn't be allowed. So I think it actually creates less free speech, which is something that we want more of here, generally speaking.
So this is something that always interests me. Maybe you have a take on this. In what way legally? Because, I mean, the social media companies are under fire because how popular they are, right? And how far their reach is. But on the principle of the matter, if I have a venue that can hold speakers and, you know, people that come listen to a talk, I get to also choose who can come in and give a talk and who can listen and applaud and love it and whatever. Or if I run a newspaper with an op-ed section that where people can, you know, submit articles, letters to the editor and so on. In what way are they treated differently, or are they treated the same, whether me owning that venue or me having an op-ed section in my newspaper? Are they the same than a social media company allowing people to post?
That's an excellent question. That is what a lot of the arguments hinged on in the Supreme Court hearings. The court cases will probably come out with an opinion in the summer, and these hearings happened just a couple weeks or months ago, so we're still waiting. But a lot of the time was spent on defining the role that the government has in regulating this kind of speech, and we have kind of different court cases that lead to different ways. So to outline it, the basic argument from the Texas and Florida laws, the supporters and proponents of those laws, would be that the social media companies over a large size should be treated as common carriers. So they should be treated in the same way that a phone company or, you know, a telegraph, not that anyone would use that anymore, but that they're sort of content indiscriminate. You know, the phone company can't say, hey, we don't like what Donald is saying when he's calling his friend over there, so we're going to censor that. They have to treat all speech neutrally. And they're trying to argue that essentially that's how social media sites should be treated, whereas NetChoice is arguing that it is a lot more like a newspaper editorial, where what you do and don't run is an expression in and of itself. It is speech to choose to censor, also because of the fact that these websites and social media, they do promote certain posts. They have to very specifically try to say, this is going to be relevant to you, this is going to be relevant to you. It's not this blanket, everything's being posted like a telephone call where the phones are, you know, in operation and calls are being made and that's that. This is a lot different. So there's a lot of debate. And then the specific court cases that get brought up, the people who would bring up the Florida and Texas law, proponents of that law, those laws, they would argue that there's a case called, I think it's Pruneyard or something like that, where there was an outdoor mall. And in this mall, there were students that were handing out, I think it was political literature of some kind, and the mall owners did not want them to do that. The court eventually argued that because the mall was an outdoor mall, I believe, it was publicly accessible, and they were doing it in sort of a public area, not associated, the mall could put up a flyer that said, we don't necessarily support the views of people expressed here, but they had to allow them on the premise. So that's kind of the angle that these people are going for. But on the contrary, the net choice people bring up a case in which the Supreme Court allowed a parade that happened on public land, you know, public roads, and was in public, accessible to the public. This parade did not want to include a pro-LGBT group. I think this was maybe in the 90s or something like that. And because they argued that that would, you know, them being included in this parade would be sort of an implicit compelled speech, an expression of sorts. And the Supreme Court affirmed the right for them to not include groups that they didn't want, even though it was public. So there's kind of these warring perspectives on that very issue. And so we'll see where the court decides. I think that they are likely to rule narrowly in favor of the social media companies because the laws are very broadly written. If the laws were a little bit more tailored, it might be different. But I think because they are so broad in what they would include, I mean, I think it's the Florida law is so broadly written that even something like Etsy or Wikipedia falls under this content moderation guidelines. That might play into it. You know, if the laws were targeted towards things like WhatsApp or even the direct messaging aspects of things like Facebook and Instagram, I would not have a different perspective. But because they're so broad, I'm inclined to think that they're going to believe that it's more like a newspaper editorial where including and discluding, promoting and not promoting, it's all choices of expression of some kind.
I mean, it seems that the social media companies are definitely pulled in many different directions here because, yep. I mean, you have the European regulation, which tries to be as strict as possible and then also give a lot more power to the government to define what illicit content is and what should be moderated and how quickly it should be done. And then on the other side, it should be decided that no rules whatsoever exist, and that also creates problems. Do you feel like eventually social media companies will be confronted with a situation where they will have to fragment and then there will be only left-wing and right-wing social media platforms, and that with this one space where we can all be together can just not exist anymore?
Yeah, I think that if the Florida and Texas laws go through, I actually think that's a pretty likely outcome because you're going to have sites not want to risk, you know, discussing certain issues. And so then, you know, assuming that the burden that is placed on the social media sites to justify moderation or all these extra regulations, assuming that's not enough to kill any new upstarts, which is also an argument that's being made, is that this will prevent new spaces from rising up. But assuming that's not true, I think you will see hyper-segmented social media sites of, you know, we're going to talk about this issue and we're going to allow all viewpoints, but you're going to naturally see people who want to talk about the issues go to one side or the other. And I think that's unfortunate because I think that it's kind of the platonic ideal maybe, but the best site is one that is not, in my opinion at least, that's not mandated and regulated by government laws necessarily other than very, very explicit content, which we're against in general, but a site that can moderate its own content wisely. And I think, again, I'm sympathetic with conservatives. Pre-Elon Musk, I don't think like Twitter and Facebook were doing that. They were, you know, the tech CEOs were dragged in front of our Congress for, you know, and accused of election interference because of Russian interference, which turned out to maybe be like a couple hundred Facebook pages or something, which was vastly overblown. But the message was sent to these CEOs like, hey, the government's going to get involved if you don't overly correct here. And so they did. And so I sympathize, but I do think that the best system is one where the private owners are moderating that content based on their own guidelines. And then people get to decide, this is the place I want to be. And there's an incentive for the social media companies to create that space where people want to be. And wise moderation and regulation, I think that's a little bit more free to have the nuances apart from legal binding laws that are slow to move and very overarching. I think it's a better way when companies themselves can control that, even as imperfect as we've seen it play out.
I mean, one of the questions I put to Karen Melker when she was on the program was that the sheer amount of content that is out there makes it hard both for a regulatory state and internal guidelines to be followed. It seems that often more egregious cases or more egregious personalities get specifically targeted because they have a much larger voice and get more visibility on those platforms. Are we even technologically able to enforce any rules that, you know, would apply equally to everyone? Or does it have to be a bit like an op-ed editor? If you send the piece on a specific day where they have a good day, they will publish you on another day they wouldn't have, right? Does it come to that ultimately?
Yeah, it's a good question. And another one of the arguments that NetChoice would make is that even if things are being handled by an algorithm, you know, to detect, because there is such a vast amount of quantity, the way that that algorithm is programmed is also somewhat of an editorial decision. It is somewhat of an expressive choice for them to program in certain ways. And so I think when it comes down to it, the resource requirements of moderating individual things is too vast for a big site. And unfortunately, for small sites and upstarting sites, that is also a big ask for them. Even if they have fewer users and fewer posts to moderate, they probably have to do it a little bit more manually until their algorithms are better and perfected. It's not just like once the algorithm is detected, it's out there and everyone can access it, and it's the secret sauce to make everything right. So it is demanding on human resources as well for smaller companies, and for bigger companies, it's just an impossibility to have any kind of manual review. So you kind of get the worst of both worlds there. But that again, the plaintiffs, I think it's the plaintiffs, I always get that confused, but the pro Florida and Texas law individuals, they did argue that the burden that is being put on these companies is not too great. And they cited Europe as an example, saying, you know, Europe has these laws where social media companies, when they make certain decisions about moderation or banning, they are required to explain that. And as we see there, it's possible and doable. So if you're operating here, that is a reasonable burden to be put on these companies. So differing views there, but I do think that overwhelmingly, once you get to a certain size, you have to rely on an algorithm. That's just otherwise not really feasible. And how you come up with that algorithm is, you know, it's humans programming it. It's not like code is impartial or unbiased just because it's code.
And I think to close it off, because we're getting to the end of the segment, in terms of what we can expect going forward in terms of federal legislation on this, do you think there's more to come? Because social media does continue to be a big topic for federal legislation. I mean, TikTok is one that we will eventually also touch on this podcast as well. There's so much interest on it now, but it seems that there's odd alliances as well that are bipartisan on both sides, where people either think it should be banned or should not be banned. But will that eventually also touch on other social media platforms that might come under fire, especially in election years? That seems to be the case.
You know, I'm not so sure. I think the TikTok ban is an interesting, that's a whole another can of worms we could go into. But I think a lot of the alliances there have to do with the fact that people who might otherwise be opposed to this are supported by groups that include things like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram Facebook owns Instagram, but they have a vested interest in seeing TikTok get banned. So I think you see a lot of bipartisanship there because it helps out a lot of their constituents. Whereas it comes to regulating the speech, I think that even if it's just for show, you would have a lot more partisanship because I don't think a lot of the conservatives, even if they're more moderate or as the far right would call them rhinos, Republican in name only, those types, they don't want to be seen as opposing or standing up for censorship of conservative ideas, even if they themselves don't care. It's not a very popular message among their base. So I think it would stall out a lot more. I don't think there would be tons of federal action there. It might happen if you get one side of the political aisle taking over. You could see action in either way. But right now, it's pretty down the middle. I wouldn't expect to see the same sort of bipartisan reaction to content moderation laws as we have to TikTok specifically.
Donald Kimball, thank you so much. Where can people find more of you and the content that you put out there?
Yeah, thanks so much again for having me. You can find me on X at Kimball Donald, or you can follow our work at washingtonpolicy.org.
Thank you so much.
And that concludes this week's episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow Donald Kimball at Kimball Donald on X. And of course, follow the Consumer Choice Center as well at Consumer Choice C. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz. And I'll see you Thursday.